Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, where we help you manage your growing engineering team. Through expert interviews, we help you navigate the challenges of leading, hiring, growing, and nurturing your tech team to deliver the value your customers demand. Brought to you by AgilityFeet.com, experts in staffing engineering teams in Latin America for clients globally.
Our goals always come down from the top, and there's usually some thing that as IT person we'll look at and say, how am I increasing revenue? Like, I'm a DNS administrator. Like, I don't increase revenue. Well, you better figure it out. I mean, you need to figure out how your function improves the business and relates to your MBOs. If you can figure that out, you will get a lot more stuff approved. Doesn't always work, but it's a much better chance of getting approved if you tie it to real business value.
Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, the podcast for leaders of growing software engineering teams. I'm Aaron Syme, here with my co-host, David Alfaro. How are you doing today, David?
I'm doing fine. Still cloudy in Costa Rica. Oh, and by the way, did you notice all the earthquakes around the globe yesterday?
Yes. Yeah.
It's just insane. It is insane. I hope that people there are coping. But besides that, nice things happening in Costa Rica, so that's okay. And our guest, we are the host. Our guest was fantastic today.
Absolutely, right? Fantastic. Yeah, we had a wonderful conversation with Keith Townsend that I think you're really going to enjoy. I think anyone who's been in IT for a while has worked with legacy systems that they want to upgrade, no matter if it's infrastructure, code, both. You know, we've all been in that situation where that system has reached a point where you want to modernize it, maybe rebuild it all together. So you make the case to management for this effort, and they say no. What do you do now? It's a tough situation, and that's one of the topics that we talk with today with Keith Townsend, the CTO advisor. What did you find interesting about the conversation with Keith? Anything in particular?
That part was, I mean, he has a very wise approach how to deal with that. So it's going to, I mean, I found it interesting, wise, and funny. So it is good. Now, and you know me, I am fascinated with the talent scarcity problem that we are facing in the next decade. So I asked him about his thinking. How will that impact the infrastructure part of systems? Mm-hmm. And he had interesting things to say. Also, automation, how to go about it. So yeah, it is a multi-cloud. We had a very interesting multi-cloud conversation. Yeah, you guys you're in for a treat.
Yeah. Absolutely. I should have expected you to bring up the human element of it and the talent scarcity. And yeah, it was a really interesting points that he made around that. The whole conversation today, ultimately, whether it's the human side or the technology, what we're talking about really is risk mitigation. And when you're told no about a modernization project, that's, you know, a key part of the work that you're doing to prepare for the before and after of that. And I guess the summary is there's no easy answers, but I can definitely promise you a lot of great insights from our conversation today with Keith. So let's get to it. Keith Townsend is founder and principal at the CTO Advisor LLC, which he founded in 2016 based on his career as a technology management consultant with more than 20 years of related experience in designing, implementing, and managing data center technologies. His areas of expertise include virtualization, networking, and storage solutions for Fortune 500 organizations. He holds a BA in computing and an MS in information technology from DePaul University. He's an IT infrastructure subject matter expert praised for transforming IT operations in verticals that include pharma, software, manufacturing, government, and financial services. You can learn more about his work at thectoadvisor.com. as well as on his site, awseveryday.com, and through the prolific content he publishes on LinkedIn and YouTube. Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, Keith.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you here. Been looking forward to this conversation. Definitely been enjoying your AWS Everyday posts. How did you get involved in CTO consulting? What types of clients do you work with?
So, you know, just like most people, I started my career what we called in management consulting in industry. So, you know, those verticals, pharma, financial services, et cetera, fell into an opportunity at PwC back in 2012. We wanted to move from the East Coast back to the Midwest. I had a stint at Lockheed Martin, and the opportunity came up to work with PwC, which, you know, obviously I've heard of PwC, the huge accounting firm, had no idea they had a technology practice or even what management consulting was. Interviewed and spent the next couple of years stepping away from the day-to-day technology and more of taking a look at this from a broader business perspective. Forever changed me in my career.
Awesome. And many years later now, this has led you to the content I mentioned. I've been enjoying the AWS every day. Now, your work is not exclusive to AWS, but I'm curious to hear a little bit more about that project, how it came about, and how you keep up the energy for posting videos every day about it.
Yeah, so funny enough, and I think some of this audience will recognize the name Kelsey Hightower, who's he's now past a principal engineer at Google. He's a level 9 engineer at Google. We ran into each other at VMware Explorer in Europe last year, and I was getting some career advice from him. He's very well known for getting career advice. And he said, Keith, you have to expand beyond this data center stuff. I'm like, well, I do more than data center stuff. It's, you know, obviously you can't be in this space and not do cloud. He said, well, you're developing a reputation for being a data center guy. I said, well, let me fix that. And I started creating this content. What better way to break the reputation of being a data center guy than to start a series, AWS Every Day? I looked at the product page for AWS, 238 products as of this podcast. And I'm thinking, man, I don't know. I couldn't name, you know, beyond the top 10, you know, there's S3, right. Blah, 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 EC2, Direct Connect. What are these products? And if I don't know them, chances are other folks don't know them. So, you know, just a quick blurb every day. It helps me to familiarize myself with products I don't know. And if I don't know them, chances are most people listening to the podcast doesn't know these topics. Now, the cadence of doing it every day, I was literally doing it every day of the week, Monday through Sunday, and that got a little bit much. So I pulled back to 5 days a week, and then I put out a call for folks who want to jump in and get into areas that they're experts in. Obviously, I'm not an expert in everything that AWS does. So Joe Peterson had been kind enough of Clarify 360 to jump in and do all of the security related products.
Awesome. So you said 238 AWS products. That's even more than I would have guessed. There's probably a dozen we work with also. So how many of those 208 have you gotten through at this point?
So we're at about 45 of the 238. And this is something that could go on for years because, you know, you look at EC2 by itself. Obviously, there is over 1,000 combinations of type and size, etc. But then they have EC2 at the edge. I was just listening to a podcast the other day, Day 2 Cloud over on the Packet Pushers, where they were interviewing a VP of Edge, EC2 Edge, or computing at the edge, and they were just talking about the various forms EC2 comes in the edge, whether it's in zone, in local zones, AZs, or if they're in outposts. So even after we're done with the series, I can see this going on because there's the sub components, there's services in each one of the different products.
Yeah, you've got some job security for a while making those videos for sure.
Keith, I now that you're mentioning these transition or juggling between the two worlds, being a data center guy and then going to the AWS, I mean, going to cloud, and clarifying that you actually have the skills to live in both. You reminded me of an article that probably you have heard of. It's David Heinemeier from Basecamp. And hey, he made a very interesting post about why we're living in the cloud. And he made an argument that in their circumstances, it doesn't make sense for them to stay in the cloud. Although I don't agree with some things he said, I think that he's making a very intriguing argument. What do you think? Have you seen the argument?
I've seen this argument, and I've made the argument. I don't know if I would make the argument for a born-in-the-cloud company to move back to the data center or move to the data center for the first time. That seems a bit ambitious because there's I've had this conversation with clients in the past. If you've evacuated the data center and you've moved on and you've lost that muscle memory, moving back to the data center is much more difficult than you think. Versus if you're in a hybrid infrastructure today where you have some cloud assets and some data center assets, moving workloads back and forth really isn't that big of a deal. Like if I moved SAP to the cloud and I have a colo and I find out that, oh, you know what? SAP in the cloud is really not a great idea. Let me move it back on-prem. That's not a big deal. Now, if I've developed applications for the public cloud and I'm, you know, addicted to Lambda and all these other services that's really difficult to replicate on premises, it's quite jarring to run that stuff because you really do need experts in cloud and data center control plane, and that skill is not as ample as it once was.
Right. So does it mean that the skill set for running data centers is in decline because what is more in demand are cloud skills for the infrastructure guy? Does it make sense?
Yeah, I would say that the skill for running data center is in decline. If you look back, you can now have a seasoned IT professional that's never done cloud. Like they can be a control plane platform group engineer, not a developer, and they could have spent their entire 10, 12 year career all in the cloud and never touched a router, switch, or physical server. And we've made this push in the industry, and I think well needed, to have data center specific professionals make that switch over to cloud because we needed the skill from a CTO, CIO perspective. We needed more people who understood VPCs than people who understood Cisco CLI.
Right. Now, what do you think? What are the scenarios that justify having a multi-cloud scheme? I mean, having one part of the system is in Google Cloud and the other thing in Azure and the other thing in AWS. I mean, what are the good scenarios for that?
So when you say the system, that I think there's very few examples of where you have an application spanning multiple clouds. That's worth the effort. I mean, this is really complicated stuff operationally when you think, hey, I'll put my AI part of my app in Google Cloud because they have great TensorFlow. And I'll put the data analytics on Databricks in AWS, et cetera. That doesn't work out too well. What I typically see happening is that customers will have multiple clouds for varying reasons. And the surprising one is licensing. Like remote, take a simple service like remote desktop. Microsoft doesn't even allow you to have Windows client licenses in other clouds. So when you go to AWS and you want VDI, virtual desktop images, you want a remote desktop experience for your clients, you simply cannot get a Windows client, like a proper Windows 11, Windows 10 machine in any other cloud other than Azure. Oracle licensing, surprise, surprise, is much cheaper in OCI than it is in other clouds. Mm-hmm. So you end up getting into multi-cloud in a odd manner than what you expect. One, the number one reason I see it is acquisition.
Right.
Mergers and acquisitions. When a large company is going on a acquisition spree, they're not going to say, oh, our primary cloud is AWS. You've built this revenue generating app in GCP. We're going to have you migrate that app to AWS. They just operate in both clouds. And then the other reason that I see primarily is for licensing, just cost. The cost difference can be so significant that customers wholesale put entire applications in one cloud versus the other.
Fascinating. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense.
I'm reminded of a podcast I was interview I was recently listening to with a representative from IBM, whose name I don't remember, unfortunately, but they were saying the future is hybrid cloud. So keeping some things on premise and then other items of your workflow in the more public cloud. What do you think about that? I mean, is that part of what you would consider modernizing legacy applications or modernizing infrastructure? What role does hybrid play compared to, say, a multi-cloud?
So this is our primary area of research. Our premise is that hybrid cloud or hybrid infrastructure, whatever you want to call it, is the future of enterprise IT. Just by sheer inertia or inability to modernize applications at scale. Give you some rough numbers. When I ran data center for a large pharma or SAP for a large pharma, we had three EMC at the time, Dell EMC VMAX storage arrays. Each one of these things cost $1 million each. Right. So we had three for SAP, not for the entire data center. These are things that can run your entire data center, just one of them. We had three for SAP. SAP was so mission critical and could not go down. We took the most redundant storage array in the industry and bought three of them to ensure that SAP does not go down. Replicating that in the public cloud is nearly impossible. Like, don't get me wrong, you can get some serious uptime in the public cloud, but that level of resiliency, you're just not going to see. So let's forget cost. Just from a resiliency perspective, I can't recreate that architecture easily. SAP is not going to refactor their platform for containers anytime soon or for native cloud infrastructure. So from just a cost basis, you take that one application, I'm not going to migrate the production version of that application into the public cloud wholesale. Now take that across all of your Oracle Rack applications, all of these applications you've poured millions of dollars into in the past. There's no real business value in replatforming them for the public cloud. Where do those applications go? Even with the reserve instances, etc., they're just cheaper to run on the platforms they were designed to run in, which is the data center. But you still need to innovate around them. So how do you innovate around them? I'm not going to innovate net new in the data center. That's we've tried that for well over a decade, and we failed at it, it's the innovation happens in the public cloud. So you have to figure out, how am I going to integrate my public cloud applications with my legacy data center applications that are just not going anywhere? I can put those applications in the public cloud. Many people do, and they find out that it's way more expensive than what they thought it would be.
So if the recommendation is to keep if the statement is that the public cloud is where innovation happens, does that conflict some with the other advice I've heard too, is that if you're going to go hybrid cloud, then one advantage of keeping some things on premise are the things that you really consider like your intellectual property, your secret sauce as a company. And perhaps that's something that you want to keep entirely in-house and control. What do you think about that approach, pros and cons on that?
Yeah, so, you know, I've heard this argument that retailers don't like to use Amazon. Let me tell you, almost every retailer uses Amazon. They may not like it, they do it. They won't publicize it. They may hide it to an extent from Amazon, and not outright buy the account under the brand name of the company, but everyone uses Amazon. I was really shocked. I interviewed the VMware CIO about 5 years ago. This is before they made their announcement with partnering with Amazon. And the precursor to the announcement, he said, "Oh, our developers use Amazon." And I'm thinking, whoa, wait, hold on. Amazon is eating your lunch. Are you telling me VMware engineers use Amazon? He was like, yes, the cloud is kind of where this innovation and development takes place. You can't beat our IT can't beat the agility of AWS, so you need to embrace it and move forward. So, you know, I don't buy the argument that your intellectual property shouldn't be in the cloud. There's plenty of examples of innovative companies such as Sony getting hacked in their private data center that had nothing to do with whether it was hosted in AWS or in their private data center. You just need to apply the proper security controls no matter where your data is located.
Yeah, for sure. Interesting. Yeah, so you're fine with... Because as you mentioned, like TensorFlow on Google or any of the AI ML services on AWS, there's a lot of horsepower built into that already, a lot of capability built into that already. But using those services may also be a unique part of your value proposition as a company. So you're kind of entrusting that whichever of those you choose to use, you're going to run that whole workload on that cloud and be pretty dependent on that. But so many people are doing that. These things are operating at such big scale. Basically, we should be okay with that. Is that fair statement?
Yeah. So there's always caveats with all of this. And when you look at Amazon as a provider, more or less, they don't go down. Like, they're close to 100% available globally as a service gets, but you have to figure out how to leverage Amazon to be up 100% of the time. And then you also have parts of the world, mainly in Europe, where you have regulatory requirements that you are hybrid, that you are across multiple cloud providers. And you have to deal with that reality. How, if you're a financial services company and you have your customer facing resources primarily in AWS, and you have regulatory requirements that say you have to use a secondary cloud, and you have data sovereignty issues, how do you figure that out if you want to be primarily in AWS? AWS is coming up with services. I hinted to, you know, Outpost and local AZs. They finally moved local AZs last year out of just the US, and they've gone into Europe. But you have these kind of edge cases that you have to figure out. How do you meet regulatory governance compliance issues? And the edge case that, you know what, Amazon may not be in a zone that I that I support. You know, maybe I need to pull in OCI because OCI will put an entire zone, availability zone in my data center or in my colo to meet my latency or application requirements. But again, edge cases. Most of us should just be in one cloud.
Right. Let me go back to the human factor here. And instead of emphasizing the fact that the on-premise infrastructure skills are in decline, and that seems to be fine, let's talk about what is going to be quite difficult to retain and increasingly rare to find, which is the talent of cloud infrastructure engineers as the future unfolds, right? I mean, it is clear that we are going to find a skills gap. Maybe now we are seeing the symptoms of that, but in the future it's going to be more complicated. What are your thoughts about that? I mean, can I give you my initial thoughts?
Sure.
I think that this is where using robots, using artificial intelligence, using more automation is going to try to alleviate that gap by having more automation in how things are monitored in the entire infrastructure for your company. But I think that's it. I mean, we don't have a proper solution for the whole problem or a comprehensive solution for the whole problem. That is going to be a good thing to have, but I think that still the problem is going to stay there.
Yeah, so if you think about the best cloud engineers, or at least the best cloud engineers and architects I know, they're a little seasoned. They cut their teeth in some form of data center technology, whether they were previously storage experts or they were network experts, and they understand low-level distributed system design from a data center cloud perspective. It's natural to their evolution as a professional. It is very difficult to grow that skill from nothing. If you don't know what the OSI model is, or you don't know the pain of deploying deduplicated storage for the first time, or disaster recovery practices and experiences, those things feed into being a full-rounded data center or cloud engineer. I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm saying that the path has now changed. Similar to, 30, 40 years ago, we had to do our own memory managers. And right. We had to make the transition to allowing the OS to manage memory versus us managing memory at the application. We lost the knowledge to do garbage collection and all right. of this process that's now hired, that's now handled at the platform level. So your premise that AI and automation is going to solve some of these problems for us. I think I agree with you that it's going to your point, solve some of the problems, but there's going to be gaps. If you've used ChatGPT, it's an amazing general purpose thing that I can go in and say, hey, write me a script that says hello world. And it does it. Or I can go in and at some point and say, write me a cloud formation template for this or that application. Generically, it's going to get you kind of 80% there. The challenge is the other 20%, and you need deep expertise to get to the other 20%. So I agree with you. I'm a little bit worried, not about the present. Well, I am worried about the present. No, we'll get into kind of optimization of applications once I've either built them in the cloud, moved them to the cloud, and now they're no longer under maintenance. Where I see this being a serious problem is there's a hype cycle for application in which we develop an application. It starts to earn a bunch of money. We build a team around that application. We build DevOps, CI/CD processes. We invest a lot. We're pushing 10 updates of the application a day. Then the application starts to fade in importance. Now we're pushing one update. Gets to the point that maybe an update every couple of months. The now it's just one of the thousands of apps that our organization supports, and that application has matured to a point that it's now inefficient to run it on the cloud-based architecture that we built it on. It needs to be replatformed. Where are those engineers?
Excellent point.
Keith, I want to go towards the title that we put on this episode for today about when you're told no. And so let's talk a little bit about, and that comes from a blog post that you wrote. When someone as in a CTO type of role is making an argument for modernizing their infrastructure, they take a technical and business case, I presume, to management, and senior management says no. Yeah, we're not doing that now, or maybe we're not doing that ever. Talk a little bit about those kinds of situations, maybe starting with getting to that point, what you need to do before you're told no, but then also what do you do once you are told no?
So infrastructure is a hard investment. We see that, you know, just from public policy to companies. It is very difficult to get funding for infrastructure projects. People don't see the thing because as engineers, application developers, we're very good at keeping stuff up. People make fun of Twitter all the time that it should be falling over. The reason why it's not falling over is because it's well designed and people put a lot of effort into making sure it doesn't fall over easily. If you've been a longtime Twitter user, you remember Failwell and Twitter getting to the point that you basically never saw Failwell again. That is a well-engineered system. And most of us in enterprise IT have well-engineered systems. So when I'm going to the CFO and I say, hey, we need $3 million to update our core network switching, or we need $3 million to hire consultants to replatform or replumb our VPCs, the CFO will look at his email and say, I get my email normally all the time on time. I don't understand where the problem is. Versus, I'd like to compare that to forklifts, lifts. If we're having problems getting product delivered to customers, a GM of a warehouse can go to the CFO and say, look, the problem is our forklifts keep breaking down and it's impacting customer deliveries. That's it. The CFO doesn't need to hear any more. Let's buy more forklifts. That this is an easy argument. So for enterprise IT folks, we need to figure out how to make the argument salient. How to take the forklift mentality and say the reason why we need to upgrade the network switches is because the new forklifts are all intelligent. They're in IoT devices and we can't support that with our traditional network. So therefore, we need, alongside of the forklift update, we need to update the network infrastructure. A little bit of a red herring, but politically, this is how you get these things done. Like, you have to tie the thing that you care about to the thing that the folks making the financial decisions and risk decisions care about.
I mean, the best way to say it is okay, if you invest $1 million in infrastructure in these things, then you will have, who will save $2 million in a year. I mean, something like that.
Something either savings or new opportunity.
Right.
For the lay folks, we should look at our MBOs for the year, our goals. And our goals always come down from the top. And there's usually some thing that as IT person we'll look at and say, how am I increasing revenue? Like I'm a DNS administrator. Like I don't increase revenue. Well, you better figure it out. I mean, you need to figure out how your function improves the business and relates to your MBOs. If you can figure that out, you will get a lot more stuff approved. Doesn't always work, but it's a much better chance of getting approved if you tie it to real business value.
So if you have determined how the work that you do from DNS administration on up ties to revenue, then you should get the modernization case approved, right?
It's a better chance, at least.
Or maybe a we'll do it soon instead of we'll never do that. But when you are told no, what are your next steps?
So when you're told no, you're not absolved of responsibility. You're still the CTO. You're still the enterprise architect. You're still the application owner for this business process. And if that business process fails because of the technology, you're not going to get a free get out of jail card. This is not how we all know this is not how it works. We can't go back and tell the business, oh, you told me no because it was too much risk, so therefore I just dropped it. You still need to find a way to do the work of being prepared to react quickly. So an example of that is I went to a CFO and said, look, your SAP infrastructure is archaic. It is just, you're using HP UX systems. The blades that you're using to support them are $150,000 to replace each. A modern Intel x86 server is $20,000 with the same capability. This is a no-brainer to move to Linux and x86. CFO said, you know what? We just did a global consolidation of SAP. It was a painful event. It impacted the business. It reduced productivity. And we promised the business that we're not going to do that to them again for the next couple of years. How are we going to do this migration, Keith, without impacting the business? Mm-hmm. I had nothing. Like that's, I can't justify saying modernize the platform because it could break. And, you know, I'm impacting a $1 billion business. Even as an IT person, it's hard for me to make that argument. But what we did do is that we started to practice the modernization motion. So every time a new project came on, we put the new project on Linux and x86 servers. We understood the process of the migration. So if something did break hard and we got to that process that we needed to do it, we didn't have to recreate the wheel. We know this. We just have to do it at a larger scale. Yes, it'll take us a little bit of time to ramp up, but we're not starting from scratch. So the point of that long story is don't get in the situation where you have to start from scratch.
I like that perspective a lot of even if you can't do the modernization that you want to do right now, being able to practice that with new projects as they come up and build the practices and the experience around the technologies that you want to use in the eventual larger upgrade. I think that's excellent. What if the modernization that was just rejected it includes essential security upgrades or compliance measures in a regulated industry, but your CFO said, I understand, but we're still not going to do that. How do you handle a tougher case like that?
Yeah, it's a tougher case, but it doesn't change the responsibility and the efforts. You're not the only one in this situation. I can guarantee you, you have peers who are going through the exact same struggle. If your CFO is telling you no, or your compliance is telling you no, or if security is telling you no, you have peers in the industry are going through the same challenges. A good place to start, even if you don't want to reach out to a peer directly and say, hey, competitor, hey, IT shop at a competitor, tell me how you're doing it. This is where you reach out to, not just a plug for me, but for IT vendors, system integrators. This is where you go to the larger ecosystem and say, hey, I know I'm not the only one in here. You're a trusted partner. Here's our situation. How are you seeing other customers mitigate these challenges? Because the challenges are there. If you have a PCI compartment that's not secure, and you can't secure it with traditional application updates, meaning I can go and harden the OS and do the things that the compliance folks say that we need to do, but the CFO or whomever said no, can I go to a VMware and say, hey, these are virtualized. Is there something that I can do in the hypervisor that can do this? This is something that the cloud does well. By default, zero trust is in every instance of AWS EC2. We're not recreating the wheel here. So there's mitigations around the lack of complete modernization that we can do. Create a plan for it, start to implement that plan, and document it. So there is a bit of CYA here, which is, you know, you have a documented plan. That documented plan was rejected. You have the mitigation to that, and you're executing on the mitigation to that. And if you're repeatedly told no, you know, you just turtles all the way down. You keep going down until you find the things that you can do. You know, I like to say, you know, we're either that person who doesn't go to the gym, the person that goes to the gym but doesn't do anything, or the person that goes to the gym once a week and tries to kill themselves every time they go. That person who goes to the gym and doesn't do anything is way better than the person who goes to the gym once a week and tries to kill themselves, and the person who doesn't go. So there is, you know, there's compromise.
Right. And they're all better than the person who just follows on Instagram other people going to the gym.
That I like to watch. You know, I have this thing where I like to watch videos like P90X. I like to watch them. They're great videos. I don't know about doing them, but they are great. They're entertaining.
Yeah, well, they're good for inspiration. And so so to bring it back to the discussion, I'd like to the idea of talking to your partners and IT vendors and getting that sort of inspiration from what are others in the industry doing as they face that face these similar types of challenges in the regulatory environments that we work within. For instance, are there scenarios where a team should still go rogue to a degree and do it anyways, or is that kind of covered by some of the kinder, gentler options, I'll say, that you've already described as sort of going down to the lower level or using new projects as a test bed?
Yeah, I don't know if I've perfected it, but I've gotten better at asking for forgiveness than permission. So, right. You know, that server that's been, that VM that's been off for 2 months, I didn't know you needed it. Let me reboot it and bring it back up. I don't know what happened. fingers behind my back. Yes, right. We know shadow IT is a term that we use for when the business does a product or project that IT didn't approve of. There are things that, as a technologist, that we should have in our tool belt that we do without asking the business, that we know are the right things to do, and that we won't get fired or disciplined for. Like, oh, we shut off. You know, I love the one where, you know, we have VM sprawl and I'm looking at this data set. I'm looking at my data and this VM just hasn't been accessed in 6 months. I'm going to push a firewall rule that denies access to that VM. And if no one screams after a couple of months, I'm going to turn it off because I can't patch it. And if I can't patch it, then it's best for it just to disappear. And right. at some point that service leaves the inventory and no one's the worse.
I love it. Shadow IT.
Shadow IT. Shadow fantastic. IT can do shadow IT.
Right. Yeah. My new favorite phrase. I mean, it's fantastic. Shadow IT. I mean, you have to be, it is an art in itself to do it right. But I love it. I love it. It's fantastic.
Absolutely. Yeah, it sounds a lot like how I do spring cleaning in the house sometimes. If you you take something that you know you can't ask if you can get rid of, but if you just sort of hide it for a while, then eventually it can make its way to the landfill.
Yeah, I used to love to wear these printed golf shirts that just had these wild images on them, and I just loved the shirts. And after a while, there weren't any. And I asked my wife, I said, what happened to my printed golf shirts? And she was like, what do you mean? What printed golf shirts? I don't know what you're talking about. And I've not had a printed golf shirt since. So there is a, you know, we joke about it, but if you see a serious liability within your company, it's your job as the person that knows the liability on what knobs you can turn to fix it. And it starts with doing simple, basic things. Like, you know what, TLS, we need to move from TLS 1.0 and 1.1 to TLS 1.2. And that, granted, is a big change. But if I start on lower level applications and we start to roll out those changes, you get to a point where, you know what, you discover there's some changes that you're just like, oh, that's just the progression of the control plane or the platform group. When Google Chrome pushes down a updated version of the browser, we don't complain that something broke. Well, we'll complain, but we kind of work around it. And we have to push our organizations to that point where, just like when their iPhone changes the OS, they have very little choice in that other than delaying the upgrade until it causes them pain and they can't use the apps that they want to use. We have to get into that motion in enterprise IT.
Absolutely. So what are with the different organizations and CTOs that you work with, what do you see as the biggest issues or challenges that they need to consider today to modernize their infrastructure? And what's their blind spot? What are they least open to hearing, perhaps?
So the number one challenge is people. People easily are the number one challenge. And examples of this is the application example that I gave you. But when they lift and shift from the data center into the cloud, I don't know if I've run into a customer yet that said, oh, the cloud build is exactly what we thought it would be. And I think that may be also the blind spot. Transformation is hard in any case. When you're transforming not just your underlay, going from private data center to public cloud, you're changing the way that you're consuming IT all the way from the VMs and servers and storage, et cetera, these kind of low level design decisions. You know, I had thin provisioning in the data center where when I said there was a 20 gig volume on a VM and I was only using 8 gig, that's all that I paid for in the data center. When I go to the public cloud and I say there's a 20 gig volume, now I'm paying for all 20 gig every month, even if I'm only using 8 gig. That simple change is an example of a blind spot. Another blind spot is that modernization isn't a one-time thing. Or a point-in-time thing. I can't say that we're going to, even if I have all the horses, meaning staff, to modernize every app, that has to be an ongoing motion for every app, because 10 years from now, day 3,650X in the cloud, I have to figure out this legacy architecture for 1,000 apps. How do I modernize 1,000 apps? So David talked about kind of automation and AI being a part of the key for cloud engineers. What the biggest challenge that I see for CTOs, CIOs, executives is that they haven't figured out, and I think as an industry, we haven't figured out, how do we constantly modernize our entire application landscape than just doing it one time?
Absolutely.
I have a last, I mean, on my part at least, a curiosity. Reactive architectures and reactive systems are growing. Are becoming more and more important considerations when you build an application in the cloud. Is that your feeling as well? I mean, we are going that way.
So
what is the impact in the industry right now about that?
I think for modern systems, especially customer facing systems, that is absolutely the case. And I think there is a desire for digitally transformed processes as we start to engage more with partners and partner ecosystems and partner marketplaces. I had this scenario that I was doing on the whiteboard for AWS every day where I said, okay, there's a manufacturer who's not really a manufacturer. They're a resale shop. They're manufacturing out of necessity. Well, with the rise of contract manufacturing, you know, as a systems developer, I look at that and say, you know what? I can create a marketplace for my designs and product, put that out onto the marketplace, and I can completely get out of manufacturing. I'm not into manufacturing because it's differentiating. I'm in manufacturing because it was a requirement for the widgets that I was selling. Now I can just do a design, push that design to the marketplace, get the best RFP, and that whole thing is automated. And I'm just waiting on the widgets to be delivered to the customer. So I'm thinking my premise is that we'll see more reactive architecture supporting those types of digital transformations around partnerships, not just customer facing applications.
Nice. Makes sense. Thank you.
Thank you, Keith. Yeah, I have one last curiosity myself. What about no code, low code applications? Do you see that happening with your clients? What's your take on that trend?
It's huge. Low-code, no-code is the ultimate desire of any application development. We only develop in languages because that's the way we started doing it. All we want people to do, we want smart people who understand the business to create business logic that gets transformed into an application. We're collapsing the stack. Not only we're taking kind of the business process owner, the business intelligence or analyst function and the developer function and collapsing that and reducing the amount of friction. I have a business problem. I understand the process and the logic. I need a platform in which I can describe that to in a visual or non-visual way. And for code to just come out the side of it. The interesting thing that people, and this goes to the blind spot where I'm seeing with customers, what they don't understand is that when you have low code, no code, even with no code, you run into all the problems that development shops run into. Because ultimately, there's code. And right. You have to do pull requests. You have to do versioning, revision control, collaboration. How do I reuse modules that were already created? How do I modernize those modules? All of that stuff, still, all of those problems still exist, even when you're not writing code.
Great point. I appreciate it very much. David, is there anything else you want to ask or cover?
No. I'm fine. This has been fantastic. Thank you for being here. Yeah, this awesome. This is awesome.
Yeah, fun this has really been wonderful.
I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Keith. Really enjoyed it. Where can our listeners get in touch with you and learn more about your work?
So DMs are open on Twitter at CTO Advisor on Twitter. TheCTOAdvisor.com is where we put our finished kind of thoughts, and you can find out where I'll be and meet up with me, etc.
Excellent. All right. Well, thanks again so much for your time, Keith. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us on the Scaling Tech Podcast, where we help you manage your growing engineering team. Brought to you by AgilityFeet.com, experts in staffing engineering teams in Latin America for clients globally. For more information on today's episode and to submit your ideas for future guests, please visit scalingtechpod.com.